Your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
In a minute, we're going to get to the real topic one for today, which is many people's dream is to get a book published. And we're going to talk with a guy who knows certainly how to do that because he's an agent who's gotten 1,000 books published. But I need to do something kind of as a little bit of a public service to you, and that is this. There are a number of people who have said to me, they said, you know, very often during the public radio membership drive, you offer, you know, a brunch or dinner with Marty and Barbara, me and my wife Barbara Nemko, who's frequently on the show, but we're a little reluctant to spend $175 or whatever. Well, I've got a special offer for you. This Saturday, one night only, I am, my wife and I, Barbara, are doing my show, Odd Man Out, where she, her job is to annoy me, which she does throughout the show. And it's, I'm not getting paid a penny. I'm doing this as a fundraiser for one of my favorite charities, which is local community theaters. I see so many people benefit from community theater. It's all volunteer, basically. Most of them are volunteers. And, you know, whether it be the audience or the behind the stage people, the actors. So I like to donate my time to such things. Anyway, at Chanticleer's Theater, this Saturday at 7 p.m. Barbara and I are going to be doing my show Odd Man Out, which has a lot of career and life lessons embedded, but I'll be playing the piano, telling stories. Barbara's going to annoy me, and the good news is it's just $20. So I'm not going to bother you with, but you would, I know what I can do. I can, let me just give it, just go to Chanticleer's dot, I think it's org or com, I'm not sure. Chanticleers. I got it wrong. Why don't you email me? Email me. I'll send you the link. mnemko at comcast.net. That's mnemko at comcast.net. And I'll send you the link for tickets. Anyway, now, enough of that. Let's turn to the main topic. As I said, many people's dreams is to get a book published, whether it's for money or as a way of proving they're an authority to kind of advance their career or simply as a creative outlet. But book publishing has changed. In 2019, does one really need to fight the long odds of getting a decent agent, one who ends up selling the book to a decent publisher and getting you decent compensation, and a publisher that does a decent job of promoting your book rather than expecting it to be all on you? I mean, after all, Amazon's CreateSpace makes it easy to self-publish a book, both in print and in Kindle, and it's immediately available on Amazon and major distributors. Those are the kind of questions. And also, what's the future? I hear artificial intelligence is changing publishing. Of course, social media is. In any event, with me to address questions about book writing and today and tomorrow is literary agent Jeff Herman. As I mentioned at the very top of the show, he has sold 1,000 books to publishers, starting with a book we've probably all heard of, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and his own books that he's written, Write the Perfect Book Proposal, and Jeff Herman's Guide to Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents, which is now in its, catch this, 28th edition, prestigious publisher even, New World Library. And his books have sold, catch this, over 500,000 copies. So it is a pleasure to welcome Jeff Herman to Work with Marty Nemko. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
Good. Well, first things first. In the era, is the era of the book, unless you're a celebrity, is it over? I mean, book publishers are getting more and more proposals. The advances are down. That's how much the author gets in advance to write the book. And most people today are getting their content short form, podcasts, quick YouTube videos. And for fiction, they watch movies on their phone or computer. Is the era of the book over?
No.
Why not?
It's just not. I mean, people, there's still a very hardcore percentage of the American reading public who loves to read. Reading is just a passion, and it's thriving in that sense. It's changing. It's harder to make money doing it.
Right.
But as a business, it's still as it always was.
Okay. Now, you know, I think we learn a lot about what it's like to be a writer, as well as an agent, from stories. Tell me a story about an author, about an editor, or about a negotiation you had about negotiating with a publisher about a book.
Well, you know, I have a lot of funny stories, quirky stories, which are kind of out of the box. when I was first starting out as an agent in my 20s, late 20s, I was approached by two obscure individuals who wanted to publish a book called Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Oh, my God, Jack Canfield.
And, you know, I read the stories that they were collected. They actually had generated pretty much a complete manuscript, and they had contributions from celebrities mm-hmm. and contributions from people who were unknown, but they were very sweet stories. And I guess everyone understands the theme of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I went and got about more than 20, 25, 30 rejections on
wow.
it. What I was learning by getting all those rejections is that if a book is only oriented towards the same audience who reads, like, People magazine, hmm. that they are readers, the New York publishers don't necessarily get it.
Mm.
And don't really care to get it because that's not really their market. They're really going for a more elite market.
The New Yorker market. The people who read The New Yorker.
Exactly. And the New Yorker people thought that, you know, I got letters from editors saying, you know, this is just much too trite and lightweight.
Right. For us. It is.
Not serious enough. So it got published by a very tiny independent press. Out of Florida, outside of the New York Matrix, and the authors really, really worked hard, and, you know, the rest is history. But, you know, that's an example of not always, you know, getting what you think you ought to get out of New York.
You know, I heard a story about Jack Canfield and what he did to get onto the Amazon bestseller list right away. He said instead of spending money on a publicist or anything else, he's going to buy up as many. This was when Barnes & Noble was preeminent in the bookselling business. He was going to buy as many books. He was going to buy up at every Barnes & Noble in major markets. He was going to buy up the entire stock. So when they reordered, it would immediately catapult to the bestseller list, and that's how he manufactured it being a bestseller. Is that apocryphal? I don't know if it's apocryphal. Does that story surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me. It takes a lot of capitalization to do that. And you won't get your money back right away, but it does put you on the list. Yes, you can game the system. I mean, Donald Trump did it with his book back in 1986, 87, The Art of the Deal. He went and hired people in all major markets to go into primary bookstores and buy and order as many books as they could through the stores.
You can't even trust the bestseller, the New York Times bestseller list. This is disgusting.
And there's agencies that you can now, who promote this as a service.
Ugh.
You can hire these agencies who will, you know, either flood Amazon with orders
Ugh.
Within a certain time. The thing is that this is not sustainable. You know, you may pop on the list for 1 or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
But unless you're going to be driving it, like week after week, which costs a fortune,
right?
It won't sustain itself.
Fair enough. Tell me another story about an author, an editor, a negotiation, whatever.
Okay. Well, the best stories are actually the ones when I was the youngest, at a younger point, because I was very wide-eyed and naive about a lot of things. So I had this client. She had a very successful matchmaking business.
Mm.
This is back in the late 80s, early 90s. Very successful matchmaking business.
Okay.
I mean, she was a millionaire. And she would charge her people like $10,000.
Wow.
You know, this was in money in those days, you know, sometimes $20,000. And she wanted to write a book about how to find your
mm-hmm,
mate.
Mm-hmm.
And publishers were very interested because she was running big full-page ads in the New York Times.
Wow.
For her service and
wow.
getting on radio and stuff. So got her a meeting at Simon & Schuster, which I, you know, at the time was the biggest publisher,
sure.
and they filled the room with all their top people.
Wow.
I was very intimidated. And we sit down, and the first thing that comes out of her mouth is, you are not a big enough publisher for me.
She said this? This is a matchmaker with that level of common sense? My God.
Yeah.
What happened?
She said, I don't think it, because she was saying something like, I need to sell. She said, I researched you and I realized that the best book you ever sold is Dr. Spock's baby book that you sold a certain number
that.
Of times. And that's not enough books, even though it was in the millions. So, and she thought that. So everybody just like in the meeting, they were just like, who is this crazy lady? I mean, what a nut. And we walked out of the meeting, and, you know, I was really depressed because I thought, wow, we're going to walk in here and, you know, all she has to do is say nothing. And she said, she had the nerve to say to me, she had a thick accent. It was like, they're going to call you and offer you millions of dollars. You'll see.
Oh, my God.
You know, they called me and, you know, said, we won't blame you for her, is what they said, which I was very glad to get out, you know, to get out of that with that assurance, you know, that they weren't going to. But she ended up, then we did actually get her a decent deal, six-figure deal, with another publisher.
Right.
And they printed the books, and they were about to distribute 60,000 books
mm-hmm.
that were all ordered. And then she got arrested by the Attorney General a day before. It was on February 14th, the day they were going to release the book. The New York State Attorney General hit her with a massive fraud charge, how she was basically screwing all her clients out of $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 and introducing them to ex-cons.
Well, this is what she did. She was doing the same con job that she was doing with her clients. She figured if she played hard to get, you know, which is a game they play in dating, if she played hard to get with Simon & Schuster, that would up the offer. But apparently it didn't quite work that way.
No.
Okay. So now, let's get, there are, as I said at the top of the show, there are a lot of people who'd like to, you know, who've written a book or written a proposal for a book. And some of them are wondering, do I have to get an agent? Can I go directly to the publishers? Should I just give it up and enjoy the process of self-publishing on Amazon? Who should try to get an agent? Who should go directly to publishers? And who should self-publish on Amazon?
Okay. Anybody, the rejection rate, you know, of self-publishing is zero. Okay.
Right.
There is no rejection
rate.
Right. As a result, there are millions of self-published books on the Amazon platform, Smashwords, other platforms. Somebody did a survey, and they found that 95% of those self-published books are selling on the average 5 to 10 copies
wow.
a year.
Wow.
Okay. So, yeah, there's a few extremely successful ones. One of the categories, by the way, that it does work well for is romance
huh.
self-publishing
huh.
because it has so much fan media, social media,
huh.
and sci-fi, for some
huh.
reason, does
okay.
very well, relatively well. Again, because there's so much social media opportunity
I
for
see.
People to get in and beat the system that way. But for everyone else, it's real tough to be a self-publisher. I think the first goal should always be to get a traditional publisher because that's the game, okay? That's the major leagues.
Why?
You know, anything
I mean,
else?
Why is that? I know they're big and they have distribution, but, it, you know, especially here in the Bay Area, so many people hate corporate America. They don't want to deal with, you know, Simon & Schuster and Hatchet and that's a great name for a corporate publisher, Harper and Penguin Random House, you know. And then they control, you know, they unless you're a celebrity, they pay you crap. Is it really a slam dunk that you should try to get it published by a major publisher?
Yeah, well, it's the gold standard.
Right.
They're rejecting more than 99%
wow.
as opposed to 0% of what they're seeing. So if they say, oh, yeah, we want to publish this, I mean, there's no other way to get that measure of credibility,
mm-hmm.
you know, to yourself, with yourself. You know, am I really a publishable author? Well, if a traditional publisher offers you a contract, you know that you're a real writer. You know that you're a real publisher.
And you got okay? a shot at getting reviews because the New York Times is not going to review a book self-published.
It's very unlikely because how are they going to dig through millions of
right.
self-published books to find one that they should review? It's, you know...
What about an agent versus going direct? You write a wonderful cover letter, and you find the right editors at the right publishing houses. Say, I saw you edited this wonderful book. Here's my proposal, or here's my book. Here's my platform. Here's how I'm going to do to market it. Should I do that, or I really need an agent?
Well, the agents have the access. Okay, publishers, as a rule, and I say every rule always gets broken every day, but as a rule, they do not want to hear directly from the public because it's called unagented, unsolicited submissions.
Right.
And the reason is because nobody is screening it, and they're assuming that there's a 99% chance that they'll reject it. So they just can't, they just see that as a time suck, okay, to have to go through the screening process of the unagented unsolicited. But if it comes in through an agent, first of all, it means it's screened, because the agent's rejection rate is also in the high 90s.
Right.
And the agent has the professional relationships with the editors and is knowledgeable about what editor acquires what and what publisher acquires what. So when the agent submits it and pitches it to the publisher, it will get quality consideration. Whereas if it comes in unagented, it's most likely not going to get serious consideration.
You know, you talk
and that's just the numbers.
Yeah, you talk about the ongoing relationships between the publishers and the agents. That would worry me as a writer. Because if I, you know, most writers write one book in their lifetime, two, four, and you very often with different agents. And yet the agent, if they're really a, you know, a major, a significant agent, they're going to do dozens of books with a given editor at a different publishing house. So they have a reason to be, to fight, to not fight with the publisher so much on your behalf, because they're going to have a more long-term relationship with the publisher. Isn't that another reason to just say, if you're a decent, if you've got a good book or a book proposal, write a hell of a query letter, even if it's going to be read by some editorial assistant. You've just got to put your effort into writing that amazing cover letter, and if it's really a great cover letter with an amazing sample chapter, you got a shot, or am I completely in La La Land here?
I would say that if you can't get an agent, you should try to go directly to the publishers. But your odds of getting into the publishers with an agent are probably multiplied by 50 to 100 times.
Wow.
And as far as the value that the agent brings, I mean, you know, what you described is kind of dark, and it does happen. But first of all, you have to just really focus on the positives, on the positive outcomes. You want to get access to a publisher, and you want to get a publishing deal. What's the best way to do that? To get an agent, because the agent will send it out to as many as 20 publishers, you know, the agent knows how to negotiate the deal. The agent knows how to get the access. The agent can give you advice about what to write and what not to write, what's going to work, what's not going to work. The agent, having an agent will end up making you more money, or it can make the difference between getting published and not getting published.
Now, I'm going to know the answer to this question, but the question is, how do you find the right agent? And then I know the first answer is, get a copy of my book, Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and
Literary Agents.
I don't
have to say it, you just did.
28th edition.
Thank you.
But apart from that, what's another way that people should find a well-suited potential cohort of agents? You normally send to six or a dozen agents hoping that one will respond. Is that a fair statement?
Okay. You should be ready for a lot of rejection, okay?
Right.
Whether you're dealing with publishers, whether you're dealing with an agent, whether your agent is dealing with the publishers,
right.
You should be ready. Now, there are a couple of hundred real good qualified literary agents, about 200, mm-hmm. 150 to 200, independent agents.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are doing is each of them has their areas of specialty.
Right.
So if there are agents who basically just do women's fiction and romance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you send them your business book, they're rejecting 100% of anything that comes in with a business book because they don't do business books. So how do you find the right agents to pitch? Okay, so one way to do it is to go to the bookstore and mm-hmm. look at books that have been recently published that are in the same category or the same topic as yours.
Yep.
Go to the acknowledgement section,
right.
And most of the time the writer will acknowledge and thank their agent for their participation.
Right.
So now you have the name of an agent that does books just like yours. And
exactly.
You just go on the internet and you find them.
The
other way is...
Let me enhance that one first, and then we'll go back to the other. You know, that's exactly what I've done. But I go further because, you know, it's like grade inflation in schools. There is inflation in the acknowledgement section too. When they say, I want to thank my agent, and then they move on, it means they hated their agent. But if I say, boy, I couldn't have done the book without my wonderful agent, blah, 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 that's going to be the name of the agent I'm going to write down. Does that make sense?
Well, whether or not, you know, the point is you want an agent who's going to get the job done, okay?
Right.
So with a track record. And you're not going to be able to parse whether or not that particular writer hates or loves his agent. And just because a particular writer hates his agent or her agent, that may actually be an endorsement. You know, you don't know the writer. But The other way is to network with writers, especially that who write in your area. You know, and there are trade associations and book clubs where writers in your community who are traditionally published and have agents probably can be found, especially if you're in a big metropolitan area. And you just ask them, who's your agent and can I drop your name? And they'll probably say, yeah. Sure.
Here there's the California Writers Club, the oldest writers club in America, I think, and you can go there and for free and join for a trivial amount. Or, you know, there were endless book fairs. There's, you know, there's some big one in Bonn, Germany or whatever, but there's also big ones in every state where there are book fairs where all these authors show up, and that's another way to meet people, writers.
Networking is crucial. If you have a name, you know, that'll also get you through the door.
Yes, alas, so many people who like to write books hate networking. That's why they like to write books. They can be alone in their atelier for a year. But alas, there's no escaping, unfortunately. We live in a society in which who you know matters as much, not as much, that's a lie.
I always tell writers that just because you're a darn good writer doesn't mean you're going to get published.
I know.
The best writers generally don't get published. That sounds very ironic.
Why is that?
True. Because the people who get published and get published most successfully, it's because they're very good at getting published. They may be only mediocre writers, but they're overcompensating for their mediocrity as a writer by their ability to get themselves published.
The schmooze factor. I hate it.
Published well.
I just hate it. But that's another story. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking about how to get your book published in 2019 and beyond. And we're also going to talk a little bit about what it's really like to be a literary agent, which sounds to me like a pretty cool career for the right person. I am talking with Jeff Herman, who sold over 500,000 copies of his books, including Write the Perfect Book Proposal and, in its 28th edition, Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents. And lest you think he's just one of these armchair people who's just writing in theory, he has sold, as a literary agent, 1,000 books to publishers. So, all right, let's turn to that. Listen, to you as the literary agent, what's one thing that might surprise me about what it's really like to be a literary agent?
You know, it's not a glamorous, you know, in my opinion, it's not a glamorous job. A lot of people from the outside just think, you know, oh, wow, you know, it's all these, you know, power lunches and, you know, high-intensity meetings, you know, with brilliant people. It's really not the case. I mean, most editors are paid relatively poverty wages. And, you know, agents can make a good living if they really are able to get through those first few years and really stick it out, you know. But the idea of the two martini lunch, I mean, that's kind of archaic. Publishers don't shell out for big lunches anymore. And so what? You know, you get a lunch and you get to hang out with an editor. I'm telling you, editors are brilliant, nice, you know, creative people, but you could do better, you know, having lunch with other people from other professions sometimes if you're just looking to have a good time.
But now I'm going to be positive. It would seem to me that the joy in being an agent is you're on a treasure hunt for these wonderful writers who also have potential to sell copies, and you are championing, you are helping them bring their work to light. And, yes, the holy grail is there are four publishers having an auction to fight for your book, and you're seeing your dollar signs and the author's dollar signs go up. Is that also delusional?
No, I mean, that's not going to happen more than maybe a couple of times a year for the typical agent. But you know, that happens, and that's a lot of fun when it happens. You know, that's like a really good day, and you get a few of those. We all get a few of those if you stick around. But to be an agent, you basically are going to have to really have a passion for the grind of dealing with words, written words, and have a real sense of what is marketable and what is not marketable, and what is readable. What does the public want to read, not just what you want to read. I personally would not necessarily want to read a lot of the books that I'm very successful with. You know, I'm able to separate myself from it. So it takes a real aptitude, and you just really better like reading. you know, is what I can say.
And you like better like reading stuff, most of which is not publishable level work, what's called a slush pile.
You know when to stop. You can sometimes just read the first paragraph.
Ah.
And you know when to stop.
That's
interesting. You can sometimes read the first two pages. You know when to stop. I mean, but still, you know, it's a grind to have to go through. Typical agent is getting hundreds of unsolicited submissions a month. And most agents I know are going through them, looking for the next client. You're always looking for the next client.
Yeah.
That's what you do. And it's fun when you find the next client. And then it's fun when you get them published, even if it's not for a hell of a lot of money.
Sure. And if you, let's say out of every 100 submissions you get, how many do you read past the first page?
Well, the first thing I do is, fortunately, most people follow the protocol of sending you the query letter
right. In
nonfiction.
Right.
So if I find that the query letter, if I understand and I see the book, it's kind of like I have to be able to see the book in my mind's
mm-hmm.
eye.
Mm-hmm.
If I have to think about it too much or ask myself, like, well, what's this about? That means there's something not right about it, or it's not right for me. So I need to almost immediately actually see it as if it's a movie, even if it's a nonfiction self-help book. And that's my aptitude.
What I'm going to do is I want my listeners to get a window into what it's really like. So as I told you off the air, I've written 12 books, 7 published by major publishers, 5 Amazon self-published because I got rejected from the majors. But I have another book that has been totally rejected by everybody. I haven't written the book. I'm going to, off the top of my head, I'm going to give you a query letter, and you tell me if you'd get past the query letter and give me feedback that'll help our listeners, and give me your honest reaction where you can picture this as a book. I'm calling it the recluse option or the alone option, something like that. I wrote an article called The Recluse Option for Psychology Today. And it got I wrote an article called The Recluse Option for Psychology Today magazine and online, and it's about the case for being alone instead of we're not necessarily social beings who need to be hooked up in a partnership, whatever. And it got 150,000 views, and I wrote on the top of the article, I said, I'm thinking about writing a book about this. I have gotten 250 people wanting to be profiled in this book. If I wrote that in the query letter, and I started the query with a letter saying, hey, Jeff Herman, I hear you're a great agent, blah, 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 this is what I'm thinking of doing, would you add, and that was it. And I said, do you want to see your proposal? Would you trash it, delete it? What would be your reaction?
What you just described to me, my first reaction would be I need to see a proposal in a sample chapter.
Great.
So, I would need to. That would be my first. I wouldn't have to think about it.
Good.
It made sense to me. I can understand it. It's really all going to be, you know, the devil is in the details. So it really is going to be on how you generate a 40 to 60,000 word book around that concept. But I can see it. I can see a market for it.
Okay. What would, if there, you know, you sold 1,000 books. I know this is a stupid question, but is there one book that stands out as the book you're proudest of having gotten a good publisher for?
Well, it sounds biased, but I did a book. Usually what's recent is what's most on my mind.
Mm,
so
yeah.
I did a book called Member of the Family, My Life with Charles Manson.
Oh, right. I've heard of it.
Yeah. The woman, Diane Lake, she was 14 years old and basically an orphan when she was recruited by the family, and she thought she landed in heaven at the time,
wow.
in 1968 at the age of 14, and she became part of his harem,
wow.
and, you know, everything went to hell from there.
Of course.
So she was, you know, she never did any of the bad stuff. She was just kind of a kid who,
uh-huh.
you know, tagged along.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we got a really nice six-figure advance, you know, from a large publisher, and she was, you know, really a nice, good woman. She wasn't like a nut or a criminal. You know,
mm-hmm.
she went through recovery as a teenager mm-hmm. afterwards and, you know, was able to have a life.
Yeah. By the way, would you recommend, if I was your brother or your son, would you recommend that I try to become an agent or who should try to become an agent, if anybody?
Yeah. I don't think I would recommend it to any of my relatives or, you know, I wouldn't recommend it necessarily to anyone.
Mm.
Unless they're already deep in the industry, and whether or not they have a real appetite for for nothing happening for sometimes.
Wow.
You know, it takes a lot of tenacity to do this job, because you hit rough spots or just the economy goes into a rough spot, and suddenly everything's being rejected. Not just, you know, my stuff, but, you know, my peers. You know, it's just like everything stops.
Yeah, and you told me that if people who try to break in, they've got to start as an intern, unpaid or crap, because even editors, you know, a real assistant editor at a major publishing house makes $30,000+ a year in New York City, where that doesn't buy you a hot dog. You know, so you have to have your spouse supporting you or your parents supporting you for a decade to even have a shot. That's what you said off the air. Is that a fair summary?
Well, probably. I mean, or you need to have another job while you're building
right.
your agency, another self-employed job, you know, because you need to be available during the day. It has to be something that I think you really do during the day to be available and everything.
Right.
But, you know, there's many ways to break the rules, but you've really got to know what the business is and, you know, how to find clients and how to network with the editors, and what makes a deal, what makes a good book, what makes a good contract. So obviously there's no college curriculum for that.
Right.
And, you know, there may be some, you know, classes, but the only way to really learn it is, you know, boots to the ground.
How do you find people? Did you find good authors? What was the Jeff Herman way?
Well, what I did, this is back in the late 80s, and I didn't really have too much background in publishing, and I applied the rules that I had used in my public relations career. So what I did was I bought these directories of clubs and organizations, the membership lists of published authors that were in these organizations, and I did a direct mail campaign, which is what we used to do sometimes in public relations. I wrote a pitch letter, and I personalized it on my Mac 2,
right.
And I sent it out. I must have sent out a few thousand letters over a three-month period.
Wow.
It was all the same letter.
Right, basically.
Saying, you know, I'm a new agency, and, you know, I'm if you're looking for an agent or you're looking for a new agent, you know, let's talk. And these were people who were already published.
Right.
So I got a fantastic response
from that.
I mean, people were just they didn't have an agent, or they didn't like the agent they had, or their agent fired them. And then they started to recommend me to their friends. And then the other thing I did is I got myself a lot of publicity at the time.
How'd you do that?
You know, I got myself on some business TV shows. I got some big articles about myself in Entrepreneur Magazine and Success Magazine, some wire services. I mean, this is all pre-internet.
Right.
And, you know, because I knew how to create and pitch a story coming out of public relations.
Right.
So I was able to... Oh, and then I had an idea for a book called Jeff Herman's Guide. It was called originally The Writer's Guide. And... Which I figured, oh, you got to have a book out there that pulls in people.
So yeah, branding yourself. Yeah.
I did a real triage.
Yep. Now, I promised the listeners at the top of the show we were going to talk about the future. You started in the late 80s, but you're pretty current. How do you think book publishing is going to change in coming years, with technology or not to do with technology? How is book publishing going to change?
You know, that's a really good question. I'm going to wait and see. But I'll tell you something. The Kindle, the whole e-book thing,
yep.
It's really leveled off now the last couple of years.
Amazing.
It's not shrinking. Yeah, but it leveled off at about 25% of all book sales.
Wow.
Are e-books. And it's been at 25%. The needle got stuck there for the last few years. Now, that's still significant, but it started at zero just 10 years ago, you know, like 1% of book sales were e-books. I don't believe that artificial intelligence is going to have a big impact on editorial product, just logistics. And it may make AI might make it a lot easier for self-publishers to get themselves noticed and marketed. But otherwise, you know, the one thing that I don't like about publishing that's happened over the past 15 years is the consolidation of publishing assets into five major media corporations.
Conglomerates.
Which are billion-dollar companies.
Hatchet.
And the book divisions are just, you know, like 1 or 2%. Simon & Schuster is just 1% or 2% of Viacom's assets.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Random House, Penguin, is just like 2%, 3% of Bertelsmann's, which isn't even an American company,
right.
Bertelsmann's assets.
Right.
I mean, these companies have other media resources which are much more powerful, monetarily speaking, than book publishing. And they treat the book publishing assets in a very modeled corporate way. They don't really allow individuality and risk-taking to enter into it.
Yeah, and they probably put most of their money in celebrity books that they know are going to sell.
Yes, or not sell, but that's the but they have a relationship. If it's a big media company, and most of them are, they have a multi-layered, multilateral relationship with these celebrities, and also, you know, they want them to be in the movie. Like Viacom, you know, wants these people to be on their TV shows and movies, also, and on their talk shows and on their cable channels. So yeah, give them a book deal and give them a couple of million and get someone to write it.
Oh my God.
You know, and then also, it always makes sense to give a powerful politician a few million dollars for a book that's probably going to be really boring that they won't write. But it's always a good idea, and that's a bypass way, especially if, like with HarperCollins, which is owned by News Group and, you know, owns all kinds of media assets, they come before Congress on regulations all the time. Not about the book publishing, but all their other programs.
Oh, my God. So these book...
These Congress people, you know, and these cabinet people have a lot of power, you know, to help them get good regulations. So, yeah, give them book deals, of course. Even if the advances are a total loss, give them book deals.
So it's one of the myriad ways to get around lobbying limitations and rules. So you could have all the campaign finance reform in the world. You're not going to tell a book publisher they can't offer an advance to an author. And then,
You know, there probably are some ethical rules somewhere written, but I just see it happening again and again.
Right.
I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton got $20 million for her last book.
I know.
And I don't think it, you know, was on, you know, I don't think it, you know, made back a fraction.
And she didn't write any of her books. She had a ghostwriter who... And she, you know, here she always talks about labor, good labor, and treating labor well. She had Barbara Feinman, was the woman who wrote her first three books. I think It Takes a Village and a couple of others. And she didn't put her on the cover. She didn't even put her in the acknowledgments. And so finally, Barbara Feinman went public with it. But somehow it didn't get much attention. But all that scuzziness, it makes me puke. Let's just end with one nice softball question. What is Jeff Herman thinking about these days?
I'm always thinking about, when I'm at work, I'm always thinking about the next big deal, you know? I mean, that doesn't mean I'll take anything I can sell, all right? If I know I can sell it, I'll take it.
A piece of crap? Would you sell it? Would you sell a misogynist, racist tract because it'll sell?
No, not. First of all, it may not sell. And second of all, it may not really get a publisher because it is so gross. Or it may have
Would
to
you even
really
represent
small.
It? Would you represent that book?
Not if it's going to reflect badly on me, and or, you know, I'm concerned about that, or if it is personally repulsive to me, it just wouldn't be the right combination of energy.
How about politically, ideologically? How about if it's a, you know, hard left book or a hard right wing book?
Oh, I don't care. Usually, if it's fascist, like, you know, white supremacist, you know, that's too far out on the pale.
Okay.
If it's, you know, communistic to the point that, you know, it wants to kill anybody who's self-employed. You know, that's a little bit out on the pale for me.
Okay.
But otherwise, I'm non-political. I do things by people who are hard right and hard left.
Okay, so you're thinking about the next big deal. Anything else you're thinking about that you want to share with our listeners before I kick you off the air?
I know this sounds like very self-serving, but I really do want people to feel very optimistic and very empowered about reaching the goal of getting published, and not look at the numbers. Just look at ways that they can increase their own odds by being savvy.
I'm going to add something to that, but again, I'll give you the last word, but I need to say something about that. You know, because I've written 12 books, of which I have sold more than 250,000 copies of my books, but my five books that were not published by major publishers, that I self-published on Amazon, as I look back, were the most rewarding. Because I loved having not to have to fight with editors about content. I liked being able to title it what I want, get it published. When I finish the manuscript and it's polished, it's published on Amazon the next week. I designed the cover, I designed everything, and I was really happy to do that. And I'm proudest of my self-published books, because the money, even the ones that, you know, truthfully, even when you sell a lot of copies, per hour of your time, you're making less than you could make flipping burgers. I really mean that. When you're to the research time, your costs, etc. So I love self-publishing. And so even if your book sells zero copies, I think it's worth writing a book as a creative outlet to get clearer about your expertise about something so that you yourself, you learn so much from writing a book. Do you buy that? That getting published is only the cherry on the top. It's not necessarily the ice cream sundae. What do you think?
I think as a default, self-publishing is just fine. But you've got to understand what its limitations are, because you, at the end of the day, you still have to find people to come find you on the Amazon platform.
But even if they don't, I wrote a book of poetry, and I knew nobody was going to buy the damn thing. But I wanted to take a deep dive into poetry. So I read 10 books on writing poems, and then I started writing poems and writing poems and writing poems. And instead of just sitting on my computer, I went and I self-published it. And there it is. I have a nice Christmas present and to friends, and it I have a beautiful cover. And what I'm saying is, isn't it worth writing a book even if it doesn't sell?
Oh, of course, because it's really up to your expectations. I mean, with the poetry book, your expectations were right on time. You know, you knew that as a poet, you know, it's going to be really
right.
impossible.
Right.
So your expectations were realistic, and so you met those. You probably even surpassed your
right.
expectations.
Correct.
Because they were so modest.
Right.
So usually, I mean, someone, if they go in to get $1 million advance, and then someone offers them $20,000, they may think they failed, even though there's 10,000 other offers that authors that day who would love to be in that person's shoes getting the $20,000 advance.
Yep. Anyway, Jeff Herman, I want to thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco, the book. Oh, by the way, are you soliciting clients? You want people to email you their query letters?
Sure. They can find me at jeff@jeffherman.com.
Jeff@jeffherman.com. And the books, for the starting place, which is not a bad thing to read, is the book proposal is, of course, critical. His book is called Write the Perfect Book Proposal. And when you're looking for a kind of a directory of annotated directory of publishers, editors, and literary agents, in addition to Jeff Herman. That's the book, Jeff Herman's Guide to Book Publishers, Editors, and Literary Agents, published by New World Library. And so thanks very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco, Jeff.
Thank you. It's been great.
Good. Take care.
Have a good
night. Okay. We don't have a lot of time, but I do want to prioritize you, as I always do, when I don't have a guest. If you have a work-related problem, you certainly don't. You can be a writer if you want. I've certainly done enough of that. If you got a question about writing to make a living, whether it be books or articles or in video form or whatever, I'd be happy to try to help you out. But any kind of work-related problem is my game, because I'm really a career counselor. The writing thing is something I just passionately do on the side, like I do this radio show. But if you have any work-related problem, this is my pro bono work. I do this for you. Just call in, and this is the time to call when the lines are available. It's free. This is my pro bono work here at KALW. The phone number at Work with Marty Nemco for what I call a workover, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And as regular listeners to the show know, I love tweeting, because it's an easy way for me to have a repository of my best ideas, and I've got a couple thousand followers, so I know that as soon as I post it, there'll be a couple thousand people at least seeing it. And every so often, I look through all my tweets. They're not all about career. I look through my tweets, and I ask myself, which of them might be relevant for my dear listeners here at KALW to benefit from? And so here are, I came up with 7 of them in the last couple months, The first one is a way to get an entrepreneurial idea. As Japan did with German cameras, pick a surprisingly expensive item that is made in a high-cost country and get one made of equal quality in a low-cost country. For example, top-rated Italian restaurant-grade espresso machines cost $7,000. Somehow it seems that should be able to be made less in a low-cost country. It's just one of many, many, many ways to develop an entrepreneurial idea. I have many more of these tweets, but as I always want to do, I want to prioritize you. So we're going to go to the phones, but I'll first give out the phone number again. If you would like a workover, you got a work-related problem, I'll do my best to help you. I am a career counselor. Marty Nemko here at KALW, 415-841-4134 is the phone number here for the show, and for a workover, 415-841-4134. And now to the phones. Welcome to the show. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hi, my name is Kristen, and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Sure.
I have been in the tech world, kind of found myself there circuitously through economic crashes of sorts. And next thing you know, I'm in Silicon Valley working in software asset management, and it's never a place I ever dreamed of being.
Right.
I think it's some people's dream and goal to be in some of these fancy companies where I landed, and it's not mine.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm feeling stuck. I'm 56.
Mm.
I want out.
Mm-hmm.
It is exhausting for my body and mind to sit in front of a computer all day. It's never been, like I said, a dream, but I feel stuck there because of the cost of living here and what jobs will pay enough money. And so I'm trying to reroute myself, and I guess I've got some fears because I'm of my age and kind of scared and feeling stuck, that I'm stuck in this line of work. And so looking for ideas, I'm looking at other things like real estate and some things that would get me out from behind a computer all day that might possibly have a revenue there that isn't going to take a degree that I have to go back to school for,
right,
which I'm not opposed to. But again, trying to also work with my age and just feeling stuck.
Okay. First of all, you know, I thought I knew just about every career. I don't know what software asset manager is. What's that?
Yeah, it is somewhat new. So I got into some companies where I actually was helping to build the program, and it's where companies are managing their software, which they call software assets, from a both legal perspective to make sure they're using them within their legal use rights. So there's a lot of contract involved, you know, reviewing and whatnot. And then also from a cost perspective, or, you know, being cost smart, cost avoidance, cost savings, that kind of thing. So getting a better hold on their assets. For a while there, audits were a really big deal in the Valley when after the economic collapse 2008, 2007, suddenly companies were getting audited for their software use. And they could be fined and pay millions. And so we had to become really aware of what we owned. Were engineers, anybody downloading and weren't supposed to be, because that wasn't part of our contract. You know, you get only so many licenses.
Got it. So they bought a hundred licenses and 10,000 people used the software.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So that kind of got it became a little bit more of a necessity because of that. And then now people are also seeing the reason around cost, you know, cost savings and cost avoidance. But I, again, kind of fell into this. This is not a world I ever really wanted to be in. And I feel physically exhausted from living this life, and it just goes against everything. I'm a people person. I enjoy people. I like talking to people. I don't want to sit behind a computer all day long.
Of course.
But
it's not healthy either.
Stuck.
Yeah. One more background question. You had said that, you know, it sounded like you work for some of the glamour companies, whether it be Facebook or, you know, HP or whatever.
Yeah.
Give us a window into what it's really like behind the glamorous public image. What's it really like to work at those companies?
Oh, dear. Do you really want to know?
You bet.
Well, I mean, there is some glamour because there's the perks. And, you know, I live up in the East Bay up in Oakland, and you know, they bust us down to the Valley, so that's a perk. And then there was a lot of little side benefits here and there that we got that was, you know, special events and things like that and delicious food and things. But the reality is, it's not glamorous, and I find that that's another reason why I want to not be in it, because I think that people are such, we're important, and yet you feel more like a expendable commodity.
Right.
There's a real there's a feeling that you get working in that environment that you really don't matter, mm-hmm. and there's an intensity and a stress that's a constant, mm-hmm. and you're supposed to also be on when you're on vacation. Your mm-hmm. phone's supposed to be on, mm-hmm. and there's an intensity behind it and a stress around it that's not healthy.
Right, I can see that. So you've talked about healthy lifestyle. You've talked about being a people person. So, and you never dreamt, you said it a couple of times, you never dreamt you'd end up, you kind of fell into this. So, should you be doing something regarding people and living healthily?
Yes, I have thought about that. I was looking at even being a health coach, but then I realized nobody that I know in my whole world has ever hired a health coach. Mm-hmm. So, like, why would I do that if I never hear anybody ever hiring health coaches?
Well,
So I did look into that.
Okay. A couple of thoughts. Yes, it's still a pioneering field. Wellness coaching is going to grow. I really believe it, because I think we're going to have single-payer health care, and it's going to be very hard to get access to the regular medical systems, so people are going to be scared into trying to be living healthier, lowering their stress, eating better, exercising more, not vaping themselves into oblivion, etc. So I think it's growing, but it sounds like it's a little too pioneering, and you don't sound marketing-oriented enough to try to be a pioneer and get clients. So I'm not going to go there. But in terms of being employed, certainly, for example, as you well know, there are corporate wellness centers. So as you know, much as big corporate America is evil, they are in the vanguard of providing wellness centers, not just exercise,
right.
but they do provide coaching. So what if I said, while you're still working, I don't know if you can afford to take time off, but while you're working, get a certification in one of these wellness training courses through one of these wellness training accrediting organizations. But while you're working, network your way with the people who are running your fancy companies, a wellness center or whatever, and see if you can get your transition into a job like that, or if not for your current company, either for one you worked for in the past, because you said you worked for a few, and you're 56, which is a plus because you've had the decades to build relationships, but find your way into one of those corporate wellness centers as a wellness coach. What do you like and not like about that vision?
I like the idea of being in wellness because that is a big part of my life. I used to work in health and fitness for many years in marketing and sales. Corporate, maybe because it would produce some money. That's the thing I keep coming back to. I don't feel like I have the cushion I had when I was younger to maybe make too many mistakes here financially. Mm-hmm. Now I feel like, hey, I've got to make sure I've got money always, at this age.
So I'm not asking you to quit. I'm saying take a course, network your way while you're still working. If it doesn't work, you can just think of it as a hobby. You're interested in wellness anyway.
Right.
If it works, you've made the transition into your kind of really ideal career while leveraging your connections in your... Does that feel right, or does that feel wrong, if you're really being honest with me, Kristen?
Pardon?
Does that really feel right or wrong, if you're being honest with me, Kristen?
To get the certificate on the side.
Yep, and then seeing if you can get a job, and if not, you've had an interesting experience learning about wellness.
Right, right. I mean, it's something I already kind of started to do, so it feels okay. It feels just kind of okay.
Okay.
I'd love to get out of tech sooner than later, because it is taking a toll on me physically, and I'm feeling I need to get out.
Do you need to teach? You said you've been in sales. If I said you were to be in sales or in teaching in something yet undetermined, are we on the right track or the wrong track?
Yeah, sales, I kind of keep coming back to that, and teaching. Teaching, I don't know that it pays as well, but I love working with people. Sales, I think I would be very good at it. If I'm selling something I love, I can sell it to anybody.
Great. What if I said, because you're older, let's use your age as a plus. There are certain products that are a particular interest to people who are 50 and over, whether it be over 55-year-old communities, residential communities. You talked about real estate. I didn't forget what you said at the beginning. But rather than being just another zillion real estate agents, specialize in senior housing. So that, again, you don't have a big credential, but you're using your age as a plus. You like people. You apparently like real estate enough to be talking about it. What if I said you should do that, and the way you would market your business, since you like teaching, you could do seminars on how to downscale your lifestyle. So maybe you've lived for somebody who's lived in a house or in a fancy or, bigger digs, but now is looking to downscale and perhaps move to one of these communities like Rossmore, which I'm familiar with, is a great one. You do these seminars, that gives you a chance to teach, that'll get you some real estate clients, and you help them find the right place for them to live in. What feels good and bad about that?
Oh, I like that.
Okay. Well,
There's a lot of good things about you. Have a lot of great ideas, by the way.
I try. I try so hard. I know it. You know, I have many weaknesses, but that's a strength I have. I love to be able. We all of us should be doing work where we use our best skills. My best skill is thinking on my feet. And so that's what it was. Been a pleasure to give it with you, Kristen. But you owe me, baby. You got to call back, and you got to tell me whether this worked or sucked. Okay.
Okay, I will.
All right, Kristen. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you.
Bye. We have time for one more call. Quick call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. Quickly, what's your question?
Is this me?
It is.
Okay. Great. Yeah. So I've actually. Let's see, I work in marketing, and I've been doing marketing for about 15 years now, but mm-hmm. I've only stayed at jobs for like a couple of years, then I move on, then I mm-hmm. move on. Mm-hmm. And what I'm trying to do is figure out maybe I need to do something different than uh-huh. what I'm doing, because I leave the job either because, the companies are downsizing and I get laid off, or mm-hmm. I decide it's not the right place for me. And
okay,
and
I'm going to interrupt you because in the interest of time. So tell me one or two clues about who you are as a person, and I will just throw out some stuff, and you tell me if any of these stick.
Yeah, who I am as a person. Well, I think that, like your last caller, I mean, I do see myself as a people person. I enjoy working with people, but also I think I tend to be introvert, extrovert, borderline. Okay. So, I like to work alone, uh-huh. And sometimes I like to work with people. Mm-hmm. I've really got me into marketing with the communications. So I thought, well, maybe if I worked in a different department, like internal communications, we work in HR, maybe that could be a possibility. But I've had a hard time finding jobs doing that because they're usually looking for people who have a lot of experience, not communications experience, not necessarily marketing experience.
We're obsessed these days with social media and thinking that is everything. So
right.
What if I said the way to kind of do a pivot into something that has some alone time, some people time, leveraging your market experience, I want you to do a deep dive into social media, whether it's, mm-hmm. And I wouldn't do Instagram or Snapchat because you say you've been around, you're also not a kid. Your chances of being in tune with with 50, the 16 to 24 demographic is interested in may not be you. But
right.
Why don't you look at what midlife or older people are like on Facebook and LinkedIn, which, mm-hmm. and Twitter still. Mm-hmm. Become an expert at how to use those for communication internally or externally. We're out of time, but that's my best idea. Is that a general thumbs up or a thumbs down?
Well, it's definitely something to think about, so I'll consider it.
All right. Well, call me earlier next time and I'll have more ideas for you, but that's the show for today.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Again, before we go, if you want to see Barbara, my wife, Barbara Nemco, and me, we are doing my show, Odd Man Out, one time only. Just email me this Saturday night at 7 o'clock only. Email me, and I will send you a link for tickets. Not expensive. It's M Nemco, M as in Mary, N as in Nancy, EMKO, MNEMCO at Comcast.net. And that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7. You can call in for a workover. Plus, I'll talk with Lizette Sutherland. She's the author of Work Together from Anywhere, a handbook on working remotely, successfully, for individuals, teams, and managers. Until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.